Once one becomes accustomed to the otherworldly whiteness of the Bonneville Salt Flats, the eyes adjust and the landscape settles into 200 square miles of sameness. This, though, is temporary. While once a failed shortcut to California for early settlers, including the gruesome Donner Party, the Salt Flats would become a modern era's proving ground for the land speed record. Within that competition's storied and mechanically brilliant existence, there's an era that, like so much of history, is a combination of profound mechanical advance coupled with a deeply human conflict. Brothers Walt and Art Arfons would set and break the land speed record three separate times from 1960 to 1965. They would achieve these records while refusing to set foot on the Salt Flats at the same time, nor speaking to one another for years. And by 1960, the brothers' relationship had deteriorated so completely that they would work on their cars in separate garages on the same piece of property they inherited from their father. Today on Pass Gas, how did two brothers born into poverty revolutionize jet-powered racing? Where did they get the engines? And why weren't they speaking? This week, it's the Arfons brothers on Pass Gas.
Pass Gas Podcast is about cars, it's not about forks.
Why aren't they speaking?
Why aren't they speaking?
Whoa. new voice.
Oh, whoa, that's crazy.
Whoa.
Hello, everybody.
Should we talk about who's behind that mic?
My name is Nolan Sykes. I'm joined across from me by Christina Felsky.
Hey, cleanest laptop in the game. No stickers on the laptop. You can see that on the YouTube channel.
You have to earn your stickers.
I do have to earn my stickers.
Or you just make them like I did.
Yeah.
Great. Welcome back. Welcome back to the show, Christina. Christina's been on the show before.
Yes.
We got Joe Weber.
What's up?
I don't have anything to say today. I'm working on a new catchphrase.
Yeah.
Maybe I could workshop it.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, please. Do you want to try a couple out? Just rapid fire?
Sure.
And see what sticks?
A bird in the hand is worth two in the butt.
Okay. It's a little crass, but.
It's a little crass.
Yeah.
Time to gas up.
That's pretty good.
It's
that
kind of trite, though.
Yeah. I was gonna say that the first one had kind of like Richard Gere vibes.
Yeah. And then my last one, I'm not super hot on.
Okay.
Let's offline this.
It's a little adversarial.
It's a little Christina's tired. It's the end of the week.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
Let's circle back.
That's great.
Yeah.
Let's put a pin in this.
Let's circle back.
You know, I was when we were talking about like the light bouncing off the white salt, it reminded me of growing up in Wisconsin.
I was going to say this table right now.
No.
Yeah.
In Wisconsin, when you get a big snow in Wisconsin and then the sun comes out the next day, you never think to put sunscreen on, you get sunburnt. And this is the most Wisconsin thing, to get sunburnt when it's snowing out.
Yeah.
But you get sunburnt kind of from the reflection too. So like the bottom side of your chin.
Dude, that's crazy.
I know.
Yeah. It is immediately though, contouring.
Oh.
Which is nice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's a light contour of bronze underneath. Though I never got sunburned in Wisconsin
you get tan.
From the sun. I get tan.
Nice. The only contouring you did was the Ford type.
The Ford type? What was your first car, Christina?
The one I still drive.
What?
Do you not know that?
The Subaru parked outside?
I drive a 2000 Subaru Forester. It's the only car I've ever owned.
Wow.
Whoa.
I love it. It's my horse.
Yeah.
And I will keep it until it dies on the highway, which I hope it doesn't do.
Yeah. Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. I also fixed something with duct tape this weekend, and I felt like very...
Nice.
Like, hell yeah, dude.
You need some zip ties, too.
I know. I do need to keep some zip ties. I have a whole survival kit in my back trunk, though. So
that's the thing with Subarus, though, is like they either last forever, like your car, or you know, you change one thing and they immediately explode, and then you get a bunch of Subaru YouTubers mad at you for the rest of your life.
Yep. Which is also the thing is like Justin and I are both like huge Subaru people, and we're like, no, guys, Donut doesn't hate Subarus.
No,
just had a bad time.
Love the low car that we built, low WRX, high car. I haven't driven much, but I mean. I've always wanted to build one of those cars, and we had a great time doing it. But look, we did make some missteps, but you know, it was fun.
And you owned up to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. People get mad.
Yeah. Anyway, it's okay. People do get mad. Today, talking about something near and dear to my heart, land speed racing. I have been to Bonneville.
Yep.
You wear sunglasses the whole time you're there. It is so bright.
Do you wear those ones that like have the sides on them?
No,
like
that's an cool old idea. Steampunk guy? That'd be sick though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get a little top hat and get there in a blimp.
Oh, there's the mayor of Bonneville.
I wish you had done like old timey goggles though. A little bit. Like if you had like one, you know, sick. One of those like Amelia Earhart hats. If you had Nolan in an Amelia Earhart hat.
Oh, just for this
with
episode.
These little goggles.
Oh, yeah. Dude.
No, for your Bonneville ones.
That would not be safe.
Yeah, sure. It would be for the photo, and then you'd like.
Oh, that'd be fun. That's a good idea, though. Walter Stroud was born in Muncie, Indiana, in 1916 to his mother Bessie and a father who was not long in the picture. Bessie would eventually marry Tom Arfons, who adopted Walt and with whom she had Art 10 years later in Akron, Ohio.
Art Arfon from Akron.
So the boys would work after school at the feed mill. Art recalled that he would go to school until about 3:30, then would go to the mill where he would work until about 9 or 10 at night. The family was, quote, outdoor toilet and water pump poor, similar to much of the community that they lived in.
You gotta go poop outdoors.
Well, I mean, that's 1926.
This is a privileged take, but it would be such a bummer to be like a child working till 9 or 10 and you still don't have a toilet inside.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, dude.
Yeah,
I'm giving my childhood for this. Dang,
that sucks, man.
I personally like peeing outside, though.
I do too, actually.
Great. Yeah,
I prefer it.
I pee in my backyard.
I'm sorry, I go camping a lot. I genuinely do more than the outhouses they have. I'm like, oh, give me a rock in a bush. I don't need this.
Yeah, you feel that breeze on your bum? It's
nice. I'm chill.
Given the 10-year difference in the brothers' age, Walt and Art barely had a relationship growing up. Walter would babysit young Art, but soon after Art started school, Walt entered the Navy. Art soon befriended Ed Snyder, a boy who lived in the same community. But growing up poor during the Depression meant the kids worked the same hours as the adults, with the goal being survival. Both Art and Ed worked nonstop. Art later said, quote,
"As a kid, I never played baseball, football, or nothing. Not only did I never play on a team, I never played them at all. We never had nothing. Maybe never had nothing."
This is in the script, by the way.
Maybe never having nothing has driven me a little. I don't know.
Around the time Walt left the Navy, 17-year-old Art convinced his parents to let him join at the end of his junior year. He was assigned to diesel mechanic school, where he would learn to fix the engines and mechanicals of the troop carrier planes. When he was eventually deployed, Art served in the Pacific Theater in World War II. During active duty, Art would open and close the bay door of the carrier plane, allowing troops to exit or enter active combat zones. The door was operated by Art and the gunner's mate, who would operate a crank on either side to open and close the door. And while it functioned correctly, Art recalls, quote,
"It was a slow, tedious process. From the enemy's point of view, it was a real shooting gallery. Heads pop up and down. So I decided to do something about it."
Art built a starter motor with a cable that allowed the door to open and close mechanically, and much more importantly, quickly. Art served until 1946 and fought in the Battle of Okinawa, the bloodiest battle in the Pacific Theater. Art returned from the Navy in 1946 to his father's feed mill, where he worked with Walt. The brothers, now 20 and 29, found they had a shared love of motorcycles and built a close bond over fixing bikes and engine work in general. The elusive brotherhood of their formative years had finally coalesced. Ooh, that is flowery.
I know. It's like Jimmy Pennington. Hey, Jimmy.
I love it. The brothers' love of motorcycles soon expanded outwards and upwards. They bought a plane.
Hey, you want to buy a plane with me?
It was a surplus Volte BT-13 pilot maker, which I assume is a trainer.
I just really like the, I like the idea that you have this plane that makes you a pilot.
Yeah, the pilot maker.
Like, you're not a pilot until you do the pilot maker.
It's a convertible.
It is a convertible. It has a
sliding, sliding canopy. That's pretty cool. So the BT-13 was a 450 horsepower two-person training plane, which was used exclusively to train World War II pilots.
Oh my gosh, I did the thing you guys always do. Remember how, like, I've said this before because I'm a producer. Yeah. Where you guys, you're like, oh, I wonder if it's this.
And because
I edited this so long ago, I forgot. Wow.
There it is.
Yeah. Maybe you'll go a little bit easier on us.
Yeah.
Now.
No whip cracking anymore. For real.
After the war, there were so many decommissioned planes, they were shockingly cheap to buy. I mean, the government's got to get rid of them, right? So the brothers rebuilt the engine and cut 6 feet off the wingtips so they could fly it under the bridges being built on the new Ohio Turnpike.
Yeah, that's these dudes rule.
One Sunday in 1952, Art was headed to the airfield with his wife, June, to take a ride in the plane when they discovered the access road was blocked. They could hear that something was happening at the airfield, so they went to see what event had closed the road. And wouldn't you know it? It was a sanctioned drag race.
Sick.
Art recalls, quote,
I wasn't aware of drag racing until that day. It was fascinating. Smoking tires, the screaming engines, a lot of horsepower run wide open. When I got back, I told Walter all about it. He hadn't heard about drag racing, but he was excited.
Art sounds like a relative of our own Uncle Jerry. Maybe they're cousins.
Oh, really, my God, does. It's seeping in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God. Too much time.
I think that's kind of just a generic old guy voice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's also, you know, the Midwestern old guy is always such a pleasure.
Yeah. I
but
didn't
also saying
go...
like, I got nothing.
I know. I didn't want to lean too far into like the Milwaukee, Chicago, Minnesota accent.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty close though. It was Indiana.
Oh, it's very close to Chicago. It's
really similar. Yeah.
Have you been to Muncie? Do you know where this is at?
No. Okay. I hope I never go though.
Damn.
Joe and I have spent most of our Midwestern lives trying to avoid Indiana.
Yeah,
that's right. You guys grew up together.
We did grow up together. Yeah. Yes.
There's this when you cross. I think it's 60 is the one when you go through Chicago, and you're on the south side of Chicago. There's always this feeling of dread because you're gonna smell the armpit of the nation.
Oh my
in a
God!
Second.
Oh my God!
That's what they call it.
What?
That Gary, Indiana is the armpit of the U.S. And that it's because of all the mills and stuff. It smells gross. And it's not a great city. I'm happy putting that out there. I don't care if people from Gary come after me.
For the record, I've never been, but also because of like the communities that we belong in, I've had so many like punk kids be like,
oh, yeah.
Actually, Gary's really cool. And there's like a really good like brewery scene.
But
and,
then
like,
they'll be like,
that.
Oh, yeah, our band van got broken into and all of our instruments got stolen. But, you know, we went to the pawn shop and we found them there. So I don't know. It's pretty cool.
Shout out to all my Munch heads out there. Yeah. I think you guys are great.
Munch, Muncie.
More of that story right after this. We got to pay the bills.
In 1952, the brothers' focus turned to building a drag racer for competition. Their first car was put together over the course of a weekend. A Packer rear end was bolted to the back of a spare six-cylinder Oldsmobile engine, while Art built a frame, welding a spare airplane nose wheel to the front.
Okay.
Yeah. Their creation was painted, as it was built, using whatever was lying around in the mill. In this case, they used excess tractor touch-up paint for the John Deere. The following weekend, the brothers carted their creation to a local drag race for its maiden run, where it promptly shut down. They also lost the second race, but the car ran, albeit 20 miles slower than the winning dragster. They did, however, gain something that would stick with them for their career, a name for the car. When they brought their mutant car to the starting line for its first race, a voice among the laughing crowd yelled,
"It's a monster!"
To which the announcer agreed, adding the assembled fans,
"Okay, folks, here it comes, the Green Monster."
That was great.
That was a really good announcer voice. The Arfons would keep that name alive for the majority of their careers, emblazoning future iterations with the Green Monster.
I was going to say, there's still a Green Monster land speed car out there. I wonder if, like, this is them.
This is insane.
This one's got a huge engine in the
back. Yeah, it's an engine with, like, a tiny little compartment strapped to the front.
Yep. So, by the middle of that season, Walt and Art had abandoned the OG Green Monster for a new creation, one whose power would change everything. Green Monster 2 debuted at 20 feet long with six wheels.
Oh my God.
Sorry, it is insane. And while certainly the aesthetic difference was shocking, it was fabricated out of necessity. The brothers' actual new weapon came from a familiar source, the surplus yard. Walt and Art realized they could cheaply and easily get used piston aircraft engines, specifically the Allison V-12. The vast majority of the U.S. warplanes during World War II used an Allison V-12 motor, so when those planes were decommissioned, the engines basically flooded the resale scrap market. Can you imagine that? I'm sorry, I just like...
Just scrap V-12s that are cheap as dick?
And dick is cheap, let me tell you. Dick is real cheap.
Yeah, the market rate. Yeah. Low.
Yeah. I can't imagine like if we were looking for a part or something being like,
they were like the K-20s of the 1950s, basically.
Man,
that's wild.
Imagine.
Imagine. Yes. So
imagine dragons. They are kind of like dragons. V-12s.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Walt and Art mounted the engine in a mid-frame configuration behind the driver. The boy's mother, Bessie, painted the front of the car to look like the front of planes that the Navy had used to fight Japan in World War II, the famous Flying Tigers. Mm-hmm. You can see that color scheme pretty clear.
Getting mom in the mix. That's cute.
I know, a little family affair. While the description of the cars may seem like they are speeding scrap heaps held together by tape and a prayer, the reality is that the brothers' cars all looked like they were manufactured over the course of years by a professional automotive company. The brothers' fabrication and mechanical skills cannot be overstated. They were able to get Green Monster 2 up to a top speed of 140 miles per hour,
jeez,
obliterating the first car's top speed of 85.
Oh my God. Whoa.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the Green Monsters were fairly uncompetitive in drag competitions. The weight of the cars kept them from getting off the starting line in a reasonable time. Mm. So Walt and Art kept touring the drag circuits with the Green Monsters, but it was more of an exhibition act than a competition.
I could go for some Green Monsters right now myself. Yeah. I'm a little sleepy. I was addicted to Monster for a little bit. I can imagine that.
I can imagine an era when that's true.
In my community college days when I was working in the machine shop, just driving my dad's truck, making parts deliveries all over Slo County.
Nice.
Yeah, you bet I was drinking Monsters.
Mm. Did you ever
in my cargo shorts?
You stored them in there.
You could fit four Monsters in one pocket of those Janko shorts.
I miss those days sometimes. I mean, I was very broke and living with my parents.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
But life was simple.
It was simple.
Yeah. That's one of those journey versus destination things where like everything's out ahead of you.
Yeah.
Versus like, you know, the new season of Hacks.
Yeah, exactly. Great show.
Our short, yes. Over the course of the 1950s, while building multiple iterations of the Green Monster, Art is also credited with inventing the overhead roll cage in 1954, as well as the first parachute for stopping in 1959, crucial developments as his cars grew faster.
Yeah, these are huge advances.
Massively important.
That's awesome. Yeah.
The simple fact is that as the cars got faster, they became increasingly hard to control.
I would imagine.
Art was driving a Green Monster at over 140 miles per hour on tires safely rated at 50.
Oh, geez.
So they're just like stretching.
Yeah. That's crazy, man.
I know.
By the late 1950s, the brothers stopped speaking to one another entirely. Neither brother could point to any inciting incident that created the schism, but both were in full agreement that it was the other's fault.
I mean, guys will literally do land speed records to not talk about their feelings.
Bessie, Walt and Art's mother, believed it was the result of Art being the baby of the family, coupled with his uncompromising and frustrating competitiveness.
I want to pause this real quick and say this is the most mom thing ever. She's like, it's just because he's the youngest. My mom would say that shit. I'm
She's
the oldest.
An apologist.
Yeah, everyone's an apologist of the youngest. Yeah.
Walt's wife, Gertrude, concurred, quote,
Art is an exceptionally bad loser.
But to reduce, I thought they were on the same side, though. Same team. Building the same
cars.
Yeah,
but she knows Art better than anyone else.
But to reduce this fraternal fracture to some single moment of disagreement would be to miss the forest for the trees, okay? There was trouble brewing for years. Let's take it back a little bit. Since the beginning of drag strips, Walt and Art had brought three cars to every race. One for each other, and a spare. After the races, they would split the winnings evenly between them, regardless of who had driven the car.
Oh, that's cool.
However, Joe, Walt explains, quote, this is Walt now.
Okay, Walt.
I began to notice that if I'd come through with the top time and I had the money earned, he would have to go out and beat my time, even though we had the money already. He was endangering the car and his own life just to beat my time.
Bessie agreed, saying, this is their mom,
He was winning all the time, and Walter had a nice little car, and I guess Arthur couldn't stand for somebody to beat him.
The brothers' wives also never warmed to one another, breeding speculation that they were feeding their respective husbands veiled suggestions that the other brother was exploiting them. You want to get along with your in-laws, you know?
Yeah. If there's anything we can learn from the story,
yeah,
I do believe it is that.
They began arguing with each other in the shop and eventually decided to legally split the mill property and live and work separately, with Walt complaining that even in that decision, he was forced to take the lesser plot due to his brother's inability to compromise.
That is annoying.
That is a little baby of the family move.
Family disputes are so petty, and I don't think you can get more petty. Sad, I just love that they're both like living on an Ohio farm together, and they're like, we're working on the same thing, but not together.
Yeah, not together.
And we will not have dinner together.
No. And there's no way I'm moving out of Ohio.
I will not leave Ohio.
After the breakup, the brothers continued working on separate green monsters. Great. Now we got multiple green monsters to keep track of mentally.
No, mine's named Mike Wazowski.
Walt eventually added a crew to help with fabrication, while Art continued to be a, quote, one-man circus. Similar to the great Carol Shelby, Walt's heart became an issue, retiring him from the driver's seat. Art commented, quote,
Walt was never a natural driver.
Adding that his brother had always been far too nervous behind the wheel, shaking uncontrollably at the end of a race. He did, however, add that this actually made his brother more courageous than a driver who did not get nervous.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Also, it's like, you can't help what your body's response is, you know?
That's
also,
what
he's a war vet.
Yeah. Give him a break. Shut up.
Things got worse. In 1959, the National Hot Rod Association, or NHRA, ruled aircraft engines ineligible for competition.
Can you believe that?
Oh, my God.
No more planes and cars.
The common consensus was that the NHRA was trying to keep drag racing in the good graces of the Detroit automakers, and the cars were increasingly using fewer and fewer automobile engines in order to stay competitive.
So it's a political issue.
I mean, it makes sense, though. Yeah. If you want to bring manufacturer support in for like chassis and whatnot, and even engines, they belong in the sky. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, remember 140 miles per hour and 50 per mile.
Yeah.
Hours per mile. Oh, God.
Yeah. Tires.
On little tires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fortunately for the Arfons brothers, both Art and Walt had set their sights on something bigger than the drag strip, the land speed record.
Sick.
Nice.
Nice.
We'll be right back after this bit of housekeeping.
It's just ridiculous. They're both living on the same farm.
I know.
Yeah.
Where they both grew up working the shop, you know?
As like under 10 year olds.
Yeah.
Yep. Child labor.
Child laborers.
I've been there, dude.
You know, it's Bessie fine. And Gertrude are like playing telephone because these guys won't talk to each other.
Totally. Totally. And June was the other
June
wife.
And Gertrude.
June and Gertrude are the
Bessie's
wives.
The mom.
Bessie is the mom.
Yeah.
Everyone's talking about everyone. And then apparently they're also talking to reporters because we have these quotes on record too.
Oh, yeah.
By 1960, the international land speed record had sat unmoved for 13 years.
Wow. Hmm.
Internationally overseen by the International Automobile Federation, the FIA, the land speed record had risen steadily over the decades since its initial record in the 1898 run of 39.25 miles per hour by Gaston Casalope-Labau.
Wow.
In an electric powered car.
Whoa, electric.
I know.
Is it now run by SCORE?
No, there's the SCTA, BNI. They're the ones that run Speed Week.
Yeah.
I wonder though, in cases like the Bloodhound, the British land speed car that's like looks kind of like a plane. I do wonder though who would ratify that record. Maybe it still might be FIA in that case.
Yeah,
but if you're going out to Bonneville, you're dealing with the SCTA BNI.
It's worth noting that records before 1924 predate the now standard two-pass rule that is required to set a land speed record.
So you could go with the wind one way and just be like, that's it.
That's it. That's the one. Yeah. To clarify that, this rule states that the automobile must make two passes in opposite directions within 1 hour with the recorded speed set as the average of the two.
Mm-hmm.
The two passes ensure the elimination of any wind assistance, Joe. When the Arfons brothers started being interested in the record, it was held by Englishman John Cobb, not of salad.
Oh. Good. I was going to say, why'd you put blue cheese in there, John?
John, too much blue cheese. I actually like the blue cheese not part enough. Of the cob. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I don't like the chicken component. It's always weird. I don't know why. Anyway, in 1947, John Cobb set this record at 394.19 miles per hour. The first driver to ever break 400 miles per hour during a run. But again, the average.
Yeah,
the
average. Yeah. Wow.
So.
Jesus Christ.
I know. 1947. John Cobb. By this time, Walt had started experimenting with the Westinghouse J-47, an afterburning turbojet engine designed for Cold War fighters.
Holy shit.
Cool.
Soon enough, drag exhibitions were filled with cars running on jet engines. Art, however, had turned his sights to the land speed record. Walt would soon follow suit, of course. With the brothers' reputation solidly nestled in the archives of drag history, their burgeoning desire to compete for a new land speed record brought sponsorships.
Finally.
I know.
Let's get some money in here.
Let's yeah. get some money in here.
Let's get Boston Market.
Red Lobster. Cheesecake Factory. Ooh. Burger King, and then their helmets are just the crowns.
There's so many competing interests in that.
Mm-hmm. As if to co-sign their bitter feud officially, the brothers signed with industry rivals, Walt with Goodyear and Art with Firestone.
Nice.
Firestone had been the standard bearer for most of his existence, with Goodyear trying to catch up. But the corporate rivalry would soon play out on the raceways as Goodyear went all in on racing in the mid-50s. Firestone took this as an insult, with teams in the pits trading barbs about which brand's tires were unstable. The land speed record wasn't simply another race for the big tire manufacturers either. Humpy Wheeler.
We've yes. talked about this guy before.
Remember him? Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
I forget what the context was. Do you guys remember? I know you black out after every recording, but.
I have no clue, but I do yeah. remember that name.
I know. Well, of course.
You can't forget you can't Humpy forget. Wheeler.
You can't
I think
forget
maybe land speed record.
It's possible.
Definitely yeah. another record thing. Okay. Humpy Wheeler, then head of Firestone's racing division, explains,
"The world land speed record is probably the most sophisticated thing a man can do in motorsports."
God, they all turn into New York people.
No, it was like Elmer Fudd. Okay. You sound like Bugs Bunny.
I'm gonna do like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, I am once again asking you.
Yeah, once
again asking.
He's got kind of a Nixon thing going on.
He does have a Nixon thing going. It's definitely a jowl.
"The world land speed record is probably the most sophisticated thing. Probably the most sophisticated thing a man can do in motorsports. To build a tire for Bonneville is the most ultimate thing a tire company can do."
it went back to Looney Tunes.
I know.
Anyway, tires for racing, drag or otherwise, surely had to be safe and strong. But with the speeds creeping past 400 miles per hour, the tire companies saw it as a point of pride. And of course, commercial potential.
Mm.
The land speed record had also been largely in the hands of British and French drivers. And so Goodyear and Firestone wanted to put a big win for America in their advertising.
Yeah,
too.
There you go. Cool. I learned something interesting about Firestone last week.
Did
Indulge
you?
Us.
And this is for all you alcohol drinkers. This will be great, too. So
all you
founder
alcohol
Harvey
drinkers.
Harvey Firestone, founder of Firestone Tire, eventually, I think it was him or his son, moved out to Santa Barbara, California, started a winery, Firestone Winery. And then in the 90s, I think Harvey Firestone's grandson or great-grandson split off from the winery, started brewing beer.
Firestone Walker?
Partnered up with a guy named Walker, and that is Firestone Walker. One
Whoa.
And the same.
Yeah. Whoa.
So if you've had 805 over here on the West Coast, or I'm sure it's a nationwide
I think it is
probably have it all over the place now. Yeah. 805. If you've got 805, you've had a little bit of Firestone Tire in you.
That's always my first beer because it's like, it's IPA, right? 805.
No, it's like a blonde ale.
Really?
I understand where you're
it's
coming
strong.
From with that.
It's
I'm
like
very excited for the
taste.
Comments on this because yeah, beer no, people
it's a
are very.
Ale.
Well, actually, on my Untappd.
Sure.
No, they have a double IPA. I used to be all about the Firestone IPAs. If you can imagine that at 22 years old, I was a big IPA guy.
I love these eras for you.
Yeah, cargo short monster guy.
Love it.
IPA guy. Actually, that was around the same time.
Fedora.
That was around the same time.
I love
you also
that.
Had a fedora vest.
I did.
Vibe.
I went at my friend Taylor and Rand's wedding. At their wedding, I wore a vest and a little trilby.
How old were you?
Too old. 21. At that at that wedding, we were stoked because that was the first wedding where we could like legally buy alcohol, and it was like a bring BYOB situation.
Yeah.
So we went to the liquor store around the corner from their venue. They had like their own little DIY wedding. It was awesome. It was like our first like friends getting married kind of situation.
For sure.
But me and Cody and my buddy Ed, we go to this liquor store. We load up on Firestone beers, of course, the variety pack. But we also got like this cheap ass bottle of cognac. And we were just like, my buddy Ed was like sipping on that. We're all drinking. And in the middle of the day, it's like hot. It's a summer wedding. My buddy Ed like puked under the table. And like we stole some ice from the, from Rand's parents who are dealing with the food to keep the beers cold.
Oh, man.
And anyway, that's just another great memory brought to you by Firestone Walker.
I love that. I also want you guys to know that his brother, that of the Walker, it was the third Bachelor ever on the ABC's Bachelor franchise.
Wow, the lore goes so deep.
It does.
Yes. I was wondering if he was the same one, but Wikipedia tells me no, it's his brother.
On a related note, I just finished The Traitors season one.
Did you?
And Ari from The Bachelor.
Yeah. Yes.
Yep. He's great on that show.
His dad is an IndyCar driver, and Ari actually... I didn't know that.
You didn't?
Yeah,
no.
Dude.
I was like, oh, I like this guy. Why do I like this guy so much?
There was a sign... Ari Jr. signed the wall at the McLaren thing we went at. And I took a picture and sent it to my Bachelor group chat.
Oh, man.
It all connects.
Wow. It all connects. Because, yeah, his name was on the wall where we got the racing suits.
Oh.
Mm.
Dang, I wish I would have met him.
Sorry. Oh, no, he wasn't there. If he was there, you would have heard about it. I would have told you.
Yeah.
I would have been like, Joe, and grabbed your arm.
Well, but no. Instead, you were like, oh, look at that hot guy from Vikings is over there.
Well, here's why. I'm watching Vikings.
Yeah.
And my TV crush on Vikings, and we can start this new section. Sorry. Was with Honda, I think, a guest of Honda. I don't know who he was a guest of, actually.
But he was suiting up with us.
Suiting up. Yeah. And I was
just yoked.
I watched it, because I stayed in so I could get up early and go to this race.
Yeah.
So I stayed in. I watched a bunch of Vikings. I was like, oh, that dude's so hot. And then he was there the next morning.
Yeah.
Guys, it was weird. It was cool. Mm, I was like, really cool. I just saw you on my television.
I had so much fun riding in that 2-seater IndyCar.
Dude,
it was
amazing. A peak life experience.
Yeah, so cool.
I really think.
Like, thank you, McLaren.
IndyCars run on Firestone tires.
Oh, nice.
There we go. Now we're back.
While initially continuing to fabricate chassis around the old Allison piston aircraft engine, 1962 saw Art switching to the J-47 jet engine to power his constructions. But the brothers were not the only players trekking to Bonneville that year. Craig Breedlove, a tried and true hot rodder from Southern California, had also spent $500, around $5,000 today, on a surplus J-47.
We just talked about this guy.
Yeah, we've mentioned him before.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about him.
As a technician at Douglas Aircraft, Breedlove had assembled a team of both aircraft engineers and street racers to build his Spirit of America.
I knew it was this one. This is one of the Bonneville legends.
Oh, yeah, for sure. In the fall of 1963, Breedlove would set the first land speed record in 16 years with the first jet-powered car clocking in at 407.5 miles per hour. Wow. This record, however, would not be recognized by the FIA. Initially, the governing body disallowed the attempt for two reasons. One, the car had only three wheels, and two, the engine did not power those wheels.
Oh.
So, Breedlove's first record would technically set the land speed record for a, quote, motorcycle with a sidecar. The FIA would eventually recognize Breedlove's record, as well as any other who had set it in the future, regardless of wheel count. That year saw Walt also vie for the record to no avail. Walt had to hit at least 400 miles per hour with his Wingfoot Express, which was dismissed as the Clubfoot Express by Art.
Dude, so funny.
Clubfoot Express.
What a little
shithead.
Competitive.
I think sick as hell looking.
Baby. I know. I love this. It looks like a shark.
It does. Very blue shark vibe.
Street a little shark. Blue shark, street shark.
Meanwhile, Art had sat out the 1963 season at Bonneville. He was busy building a new green monster. After getting a call from a scrap dealer, Art drove down to Florida and purchased a General Electric J-79 jet engine, a 17,500 horsepower beast with a 4-stage afterburner. It was a much more advanced engine than most of Bonneville, likely because it was allegedly still a classified military project.
Wow.
I don't buy that.
I mean, I like it for the lore, so I'm leaving it. But
while
yeah.
working on the engine, Art ran into some trouble and called General Electric to get them to send him a service manual. They did not believe he had the engine. And a few days later, a colonel from Washington showed up at Art's house and demanded that he give up the engine. Whoa. Art showed him the receipt and refused, also ignoring what sounds like a cease and desist order from GE.
Wow.
Wow.
That's cool.
I know. In October of the following year, 1964, Walt's Wingfoot Express would finally give Goodyear a win over Firestone. After spending over $100,000, or over $1 million today, on Walt's car, wow. driver Tom Green, nice.
Not that
Eminem.
Tom. Yeah. The guy, Tom Green, who invented the Cobb salad.
Not Eminem. Yes, Tom Green, who invented the Cobb salad, would record a speed of 413.2 miles per hour, shattering Breedlove's record.
Shattering by shattering. 5 miles per hour.
Tom yeah. Green slams Craig Breedlove's record.
After the record was announced, Art walked out of the crowd to his brother and offered his hand. Walt and Art hugged, and Art recalls calling his mother soon after, telling her,
"Mama, I made up with Walter. We're buddies again, and everything's fine."
Whoa. Wow, that's kind of a beautiful moment, right?
Isn't that yeah. nice? All he had to do was win.
Oh.
He said, "My bum is on the record."
3 days after Walter's Wingfoot Express broke the land speed record and the brothers reconciled, Art, driving his green monster, set a new land speed record of 434.18 miles
Holy
per hour.
Shit.
But while Art likely felt satisfied in breaking his brother's record by 30 miles per hour, his victory would prove to be almost as short-lived as Walt's.
Whoa. Okay, you know what? This is all falling into place now. I think mm-hmm. in our previous land speed record episode, we focused more on Craig Breedlove.
Yes, we mm-hmm. did.
And we heard about these Arfons guys, but like because Breedlove yeah. just like leapfrogged them pretty quickly, we kind of just like brushed by it.
Yeah.
So now oh, no. I know the full picture now.
Yeah, it's like finding those last two pieces of the puzzle.
Oh, yeah. They yeah. traded. They went back and forth. Anyway, so 1 week later, Breedlove would break Art's record by 34 miles
oh
per hour,
God.
468.7 miles per hour.
Damn. Wow.
By the time the brothers would have heard about Breedlove's new record, it was old news because 2 days after setting the new land speed record, Breedlove would set it again, recording 526.77 miles per hour.
Oh, my God.
Uh-huh. And becoming the first person to drive over 500 miles per hour.
Oh, jeez.
Mm-hmm. This guy's a freaking hero, man.
Yeah, dude. In what had to be one of those last day, last run, let's see what happens if we just push it through the floor attempts, both of Breedlove's parachutes failed.
Oh, Jesus.
And the disc brakes burned out,
yeah.
leaving him crashed in a ditch, but with the record.
Oh, my God.
God dang, that'd be scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's like a nightmare scenario.
Yeah. My
rules.
Whole body fills with fear thinking yeah. about it. That's so scary. So after hearing the news, Art and Walt both headed back to Bonneville from Akron. Art would end the 1964 season with the new record of 536.71 miles per hour.
What? They just cracked this thing wide open.
Yeah, dude. They're just...
They cracked it wide open.
They sure did. The land speed record had been broken 5 times in 1 month. Walt, who is now experiencing with jet-assisted takeoff rockets...
Jado
would not compete again that year due to weather conditions.
Probably rained.
Yeah. Knowing what we know about Bonneville mm-hmm. from your experiences, mm-hmm, yeah. for sure. After the 1964 season, the racing world was inundated with Firestone advertising, blasting their feet at the Salt Flats. Goodyear was absolutely set on winning the record back in 1965. So Arthur and Walt, now with an uneasy peace, headed back to Akron to work on their respective cars for the 1965 season. Walt was a creature of collaboration, with his Wingfoot Express a constant work in progress among his team and sponsors.
So,
Wingfoot Express, Goodyear.
Oh, Wingfoot. Wingfoot. Speaking
oh,
of.
Oh, I did not put that together yeah. in the slightest.
That's cool.
There you go.
Do you think, like, at this time they had radial tires, or was this still bias ply?
Oh, that's a good question, Joe. I'm going to guess that they were still bias ply. Big shift to radial tires began in 74 when American tire makers began making suspensions specifically designed for the long-wearing, gas-saving radials. Oh. I'm going to guess they might still be on bias plies. I think the tires that we run on our Roadster are bias ply. I'm pretty really? Sure. Yeah.
Well, bias ply would be worse in the if you're cornering, mm-hmm. but I think it's fine if you're going straight.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool. So while Walt was a creature of collaboration, as said, Art tended to work only with Ed Snyder, his childhood friend and partner.
Dang, they're still working together.
I know. I want to say something about the name Snyder. That's my family's name. So it's my grandma on my mom's side.
Really?
Yeah. And
your
so
Dutch side?
My Dutch side. Yeah. We are Dutch and German. But I looked into this after. I was like, are we related? And mm-hmm. we're not.
Oh.
Anyway.
Great. Well, I mean, we're all wondering. Once you said that, my ears perked up.
Yeah.
I was hoping for a cool little reveal.
There is
and
none.
Here we are.
There's none. Art, however, tended to work only with Ed Snyder, his childhood friend and partner. Despite the new sponsorship money coming to both of the brothers, Art continued fabricating and scrapping for most of his cars, spending less than $60,000, $600,000 today, jeez. On his 1964 record-setting Green Monster, compared to Walt's $100,000, $1 million today, Wingfoot Express. Art loved testing and adjusting from intuition and feel, having spent so much of his life on both airplane engines and cars. He would tie the jet engine between two trees on the property, once what? Blowing a 60-foot channel in his yard and obliterating a chicken coop.
Dude, you gotta move the chickens out of the way.
I know. Here's Humpy Wheeler again.
He's the coolest guy I've ever seen in my life.
Said Firestone's Humpy Wheeler.
This is just like, like Wimpy from Popeye or something.
Yeah,
like
it's like a mix of all the Mel Blanc characters for me from Looney yeah. Tunes. Anyway, but all was not peaceful between the brothers once again, even though amends had been made. Both were suspicious of the other's intentions. Art recalls a story from after the reconciliation. He was looking to buy some dirt. Sorry. He was looking to buy some dirt to level a section of his garage. And when he returned home from Bonneville, there were about 50 piles of dirt in his neighbor's yard, courtesy of Walter, who had been digging out a basement on his property and hauled it to the neighbors. Art said,
He hates me that much that he would take and haul it over to a neighbor. And I tell you, it's something small, but it's the principle of the thing, and it just burnt me no end.
Walt's defense?
I didn't even know he wanted dirt.
That is petty.
But
it's also possible he didn't know he wanted dirt.
Yeah,
it's
if
so
he
possible.
Doesn't talk to his brother, why would the first thing he said be, I want your dirt?
You got any dirt? I got dirt.
I got all this empty dirt from my part of the property that we also share. We're all here.
I got 50 piles of it.
Yeah, 50 piles of dirt. I'm going to bring it to our neighbor. I'm not going to bring it to the same property.
Give me that dirt.
Getting dirt used to be so much better. Now you got to go through Lowe's.
Art's Green Monster for the 1960s.
Big dirt. Sorry.
Big dirt.
You got to go through big dirt.
You do kind of have to go through big dirt.
If I had like a company with subsidiaries, like Tesla has like Boring Company. Yeah. I definitely have like Big Dirt as
big
well.
Dirt. Big Dirt is a really fun brand name. Yeah.
Art's Green Monster for the 1965 season was barely altered from his 64 ride, save for a needle-shaped nose that was more aesthetic, really, than functional. Also, Art started having his crew kiss the car every day.
Which is weird because he painted like a big boob. He told him, go kiss the boob. For good luck.
So this is not it wasn't out of superstition, at least not initially, but out of love for what he considered the most beautiful car in the world. I'm going to have to disagree with that. Meanwhile, Walt's Wingfoot Express was the result of at least a dozen different corporations adding their materials and know-how, resulting in what was described as a baby blue arrow. That thing's sick as hell.
I know.
With two wheels almost touching in the front and the rear wheels 13 feet apart. The goal was to keep the car going as straight as possible with as little driving as possible. Art went to the car's unveiling at the Akron Conference Center where he claimed that Walt ignored him until people were around, then acted friendly.
That'll happen.
The 1965 season at Bonneville started with Walter's Blue Arrow failing to live up to expectations on its first run, failing to break even 300 miles per hour. Hey, it'll happen. On its second run, even with Wingfoot Express's 15 rockets capable of 28,000 horsepower, it was averaging just above 500 miles per hour.
Boo, 500's not enough. Try harder.
It's so slow for being so wide.
Walter and his team knew the problem. The car was too heavy. But in Walt's defense, it was also incredibly safe. As the manufacturer, but not the driver, Walt felt a particular duty to protect the driver at all costs, something that Art and Craig Breedlove, as the drivers, had much less concern about. In two more runs, Walt could add some 25 more Jado rockets to the frame, upping the horsepower to almost 50,000 and costing Goodyear around $60,000 in rockets alone.
That's wild.
Before conceding defeat for the season. In one of the runs, the rockets left their housing and penetrated the interior of the car, leaving the driver fine, but the wiring destroyed.
That's nuts. That'd be terrifying.
And they needed to get the driver new pants.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because he shit himself.
This is real?
No.
Oh, okay.
Or it would be in the script. I just think you would need new pants.
I got to get used to your on-screen sarcasm.
I don't think it's sarcasm so much as a casual joke, joke telling.
The following week, Breedlove would make his attempt with his Spirit of America Sonic 1, a car most observers dismissed as too unstable and too large to threaten the record.
Also, the eyes were too small for the first version.
Sorry, I thought
this is a Sonic joke.
Yeah, nice. Yet he would break the record again, hitting 555.1 miles per hour before the week was out. Art was over in Vegas exhibiting his car at a Firestone event when he heard of Breedlove's new record. He and his team immediately packed up and headed for Bonneville, where they assumed, since Breedlove had already set a new record, that they would have access to the flats.
Uh-oh.
They were wrong.
What?
Yeah, Breedlove and Goodyear, who had hedged their bets by sponsoring both him and Walt, would use their remaining time running trials in the new Shelby Daytona Cobra.
Whoa.
The Daytona. Nice. The little Cobra tore up the flats, damaging the international course, where onlookers were suspicious of Goodyear's intent. Art, though, was indifferent. He would make his runs on the hot rod course instead. Green Monster clocked 577.38 miles per hour, breaking Breedlove's barely set record. And then 1 week later, Breedlove would return and break it again, at 600.6 miles per hour.
What are they doing different? Like, are they just not putting their foot down all the way?
I gotta be honest, I don't know. That's possible.
That's such a good question. And especially just because I just keep thinking about them finally getting home. You know, they kiss their wife hello, they say hi to their kids, and then they get the news and they're like, and they have to get back on a plane.
I just put a pizza in the oven. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
No. Dude, and they have to like turn around and head back. It's just, it's.
But then they break. It's not like 5 miles per hour anymore. It's 26 miles per hour faster and 75 miles per hour faster.
I think that's the difference though. You know, like in classes like the Roadster that I run, the American Iron Roadster class, the record, like the margin does change, but only by a few miles per hour here and there.
Yeah.
But when you're working with engines this big and cars this slippery, you know, those increases are going to be so much bigger because the power the powers is so much.
Yeah. 50,000 horsepower.
50,000 horsepower. You know,
so wild. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe if they're like, okay, we're pushing it, but we know there's some left here.
We don't
need to do this quite yet.
We don't want
to
show our whole hand.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's their version of sandbagging or something.
I would be interested though, because you know, in a jet car, the jet isn't powering the rear wheels. How grip works, you know, it's less of like tire grip and like managing your foot throttle, I'd imagine, and more like, okay, there's like a slight wind going across the course and that's pushing me this way. I've got a huge they have basically an upright, like a tail on the back, you know, to keep it straight. But like a crosswind could affect that. So you're having to modulate your jet engine throttle, which I assume is a hand throttle, like so. And like, that's what you're playing with rather than like a, I got to like, drift this thing down the course, basically.
Well, also, again, I mentioned like a 13-foot wide back set of wheels, too.
Well, that was on...
It's just for stabilizing,
yeah, that was on Arfon's car, or on Walt's car. This is like, this is the car right here.
Oh, I see. That
Breedlove
one. And, I don't know. I just don't know how that works. I wonder what that looks like in person, too. Because, like, I've seen F1 cars go, and you're so like, sick. Dang, that fast. But, like, I mean, 500 miles an hour.
If you were
like,
standing right next to it, it'd just look like a blink.
I mean, horrifying. But
I'm wondering about the steering angle. Mm-hmm. It's lock to lock, it's probably, like, 2 degrees.
Probably not a lot. Probably not a lot, but probably maybe more than you think. But, yeah, I mean, that, too, you don't want it to be too much, because otherwise, at those speeds, if you, you know, turn the wheels too much.
You just flip.
Yeah, something bad will happen.
Or this thing would snap sideways, whatever.
I love Bonneville. Unfortunately, we're not going this year.
Oh.
Because my sister's getting married. I'm getting married. Me and my dad decided it's just, like, too many things going on to, like, focus on the car itself. So we're going to go out next year, but it's just such a magical place. If you just go on a road trip this summer and swing by Bonneville during Speed Week, go to the course, check out the cars, watch them run. It's just like, it's another planet. It's amazing.
Your pictures are so cool from it.
I know. Yeah. Thanks.
Shit, your car caked in salt.
Yeah, no, it's such a...
The salt in your lungs, you were coughing up for like 3 weeks after.
That did mess me up.
That was wild.
Yeah, that did mess me up for a little bit. For a couple of weeks, I was in recovery mode for sure.
But it also, you said, reinvigorated you in a really specific way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a...
I remember
it's just
this.
A hell of a place.
I think because remember how, again, with the IndyCar, this was not nearly as fast as you were going, but like riding in the IndyCar, I was like, oh, good, my depression's gone now.
Yeah. I think we're
you just
only
get your
going
brain
like
slammed around a little.
You probably went over 120 at least.
I think probably 140.
I think 140 was like how fast we went.
Yeah.
Damn, that's fast.
Yeah, it was awesome. I was nauseous for the rest of the day. But it did cure my depression, as I said. It hasn't come back yet.
Oh, good.
Anyway. Art returned to the flats in 1966, where he would finally push his car too far.
Uh-oh.
In his second pass, Art's car had a catastrophic structural failure, later discovered to be a frozen wheel bearing.
Oh, man.
This led to the first 600 mile per hour car wreck with a survivor.
Hey.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Though Art lived, neither he nor Walt nor Craig Breedlove would set another land speed record. It was the end of an era.
I wonder if he flipped. Or if like it just like kept going straight, because if he flipped, there's like no way that he would live if it was just tumbling.
No, I agree. That's not possible. Yeah.
Your head would come off.
Yeah.
Your head would come off.
Your head would come off. Mm-hmm. Walt stayed involved in motorsports in a more mechanical role until his retirement. Art, however, turned his attention to tractor pulling.
Hey. Nice.
Adding turbine engines to his green monster, Art would quickly win the respect of the National Tractor Pulling Association and its fans. Unfortunately, during a tractor pulling drag exhibition in Dallas in 1971, Art suffered a tire blowout and crashed into the guard railing, killing three spectators.
Oh, jeez.
He would retire from racing as a result.
Yeah.
Art was eventually inducted into the NTPA Hall of Fame after decades of bringing his own brand of power and ingenuity to that sport, as well as his Firestone and Busch sponsorships. Art passed in 2007 and Walt in 2013.
Wow. The Arfon's brother legacy in land speed racing cannot be overstated. Their commitment to their respective strengths, Art to fabrication and simplicity, and Walt to safety and innovation, was unparalleled. In hindsight, one can easily imagine how powerful Walt and Art would have been had they traversed the 50 yards between workspaces and collaborated on one car.
It's so funny.
But truly, there may be a better, less healthy argument to be made that the brothers' inability to repair their fractured relationship is what led them to greatness. Art's competitiveness needed a foil, and who better than a family member to foster a well of unresolved resentment driving him to recklessness and innovation. So, we'll leave you with this quote from Art on Walt.
My brother has a real good personality. He's a real pleasant guy, and he is sharper than anyone gives him credit for. And he knows how to make an ass out of me 8 ways from Sunday.
There you go.
There you go. It's so good.
That's a great story.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Those guys are fun.
Yeah, they're so like colorful characters, I'd
definitely
say.
Yeah.
Man, I really love that we have a fuller view now of that whole Breedlove storyline, because we did talk about that a few months ago.
And the Shelby Daytona.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
Right?
That slipped in
like
there.
Randomly just like, hey, by the way, here's this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fun. We got some listener mail. Jake, Joe, from Jake.
This is from Jake. Subject: hey, you guys like ska? Question mark. And it, all it says is, that's pretty much all I wanted to know. Love the show.
I love Real Big Fish and Mighty Mighty Bosstones. I will say that.
I love ska so much that I'm going to go to a punk festival that has Fishbone and the Aquabats. So I love ska. I know, you know, it was corny and then it became cool again. I was there for all of it.
It's still kind of cool.
I used to like Mustard Plug, and I still like Operation Ivy.
Nice.
I love Catch 22.
Unity. Okay.
Catch 22, one of my favorite bands.
Good right. stuff in there. Yeah. All right, thank
we
you, Jake.
We like ska. Thanks, Jake.
Follow Christina Felsky at Christina Felsky on Instagram.
It's with a K.
That's right. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me and Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. Big thanks to the crew, Audrey Holden, Nick Giamuso, Gavin Kinzel. We'll see you next time. Thanks.
And thanks to our writer, Jimmy Pennington.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll see you later next time. Yeah. Thanks.